Hi, this is Scott Goro from Thin Lizzy, and you're listening to the Rock Solid Podcast.
Make me a deal and make it good for me. I won't get full of myself, I can't afford to be. This is small town music, this is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away, a song away, a song away.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis, and joining me in the Zoom room today to promote the release of The Boys Are Back in Town Live, plus the documentary Songs for While I'm Away, please welcome the guitarist for the legendary band Thin Lizzy, Mr. Scott Gorham. How you doing, Scott?
Great, Pat. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, man. This is great.
Look, I'm excited about this. So this new release drops on June 24th, recorded live in October of 78 at the Sydney Opera House. The band lineup is Phil on bass, Scott and Gary Moore on guitars, and Mark Nassif on drums.
Nassif.
Nassif. So my question is, where was Brian Downey?
Well, unfortunately, he decided to quit the band about a month before we were supposed to go out, right? So you know, kind of panic ensues, you know, oh my God, are we going to need to cancel? And was one of those kind of guys, no matter what sort of disaster hit you, we were never not going to go out on any tour, right? So what happened was somebody in the management got up a list of these kind of A drummers, you know, the VIP kind of drummers, right? And we're going to go to Los Angeles and we're going to have a jam with them, because, you know, I guess an audition, really.
Yeah.
Well, two of them I can't remember, and I'm sorry, they'll probably hate me for the rest of their lives not remembering their names, right? But I do remember one of them was Terry Bozzio.
Oh, right? Okay, from Missing Persons.
There you go, up. Man. Great. I mean, he's like a top class drummer, and yeah. You know, we start our kind of mini set in our jam session there, and he had this set down, and I could not, he had every Downey lick under his belt.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, really, this is amazing. He's the guy, you know. And he was okay with the money, he was okay with the time frame. There was a little bit of a problem though. He wanted us to fly his girlfriend around with him everywhere, right? Now, we just did not do that,
right? But
take the wives or girlfriends, because it was just all business for us, right?
Yeah.
So, okay, well, next. And then we got to Mark Nassif. And right off the bat, his personality just hit perfect. You know, his sense of humor, the way he thought about things. He then got on the drums and he just killed it, right? And he was the guy, you know. And if you see on the tape, he really is the guy.
Yeah,
you know?
He was great. He was fantastic.
No kidding.
So, but the door's open if Brian Downey wanted to come back, and obviously he does.
Well, he did. There was a little bit of problem. You know, Phil and I loved Mark. We just thought he was great, you know. So Phil really was thinking Mark Nassif, he's going to be our guy, right?
Be the new guy.
Right. But, you know, I'm always been of that ilk. The more original guys you have in the band, the better, you know, for the fans and all that. They all want to see a familiar face. Even as good as Mark actually was, hey, Phil, we really need to get Brian back, you know. And it took a little bit of, you know, discussion, but he finally relented, and I called up Brian and said, hey, what do you think? And he said, absolutely. You know, I think he knew he had made a
mistake,
mistake by the way it all went down. So it was all fine after that.
And then, but then you have to tell Mark that he's out.
Right. What a terrible moment that is. Right?
Yeah, that's not good. He just came in and saved your ass.
Right. He saved the day. Right. And he did such a wonderful job. And like you say, you could see it on the tape. And then, yeah, we had to tell Mark. And yeah, you know, he was shattered because he knew we were all great friends now. We had been through the wars together, maybe a short war, but it was still, you know, it was tough. And I think he was shattered. He still loves Thin Lizzy today. You know, he will not say a bad word about the whole thing. And he really loves this concert also, the way it got mixed and all that. Yeah. So in the end, it was all kind of happy days and handshakes and all that.
Good. Good to know. Now, here's my question about the show. It's a 13-track set list. Is that the entire show, or were there some songs edited out for this release?
No, there was no editing done. You got to remember, we had lost the tapes, the audio and the visual for, you know, a few decades.
Yeah. Really.
There was a couple of people. One had the visual tapes and somebody else had the audio side. And, you know, thank God they did, really, because who knows what would have happened to them. But it was the way they were stored. You know, some of the songs, the tapes were oxidized, so completely destroyed. We couldn't use them. The same with the visuals. The couple of the visuals were just so unusable. We just couldn't use them. But, the way I think it's, you know, we brought the rest of the concert up to such a great level. I'm pretty sure the Lizzy fans, and maybe we'll get a new bunch of fans from this too, I think they'll forgive us for not showing the whole set. You know, at least that's what I'm hoping.
All right, cool. Now, I'm going to go through the track list, but I'm not going to go through it in the order that it was played. I'm going to go through it chronologically, so that way we can touch on your tenure in Thin Lizzy, if that makes sense.
Man, you're going to be testing my memory there, buddy.
Well, I'm not going to ask
you another question.
I won't ask you anything too difficult, I promise. So, you play Still in Love With You. That's from 1974's Nightlife.
I think I'll form pieces if I don't find something else to do. The sadness never ceases. Head keeps on reeling, and it's got me in a crisis.
That was your first time in the studio with Thin Lizzy.
Right.
Working with Ron Nevison. Now, was that really your first time in big studio recording, things like that?
Actually, no, it wasn't. I did a couple of things in Los Angeles, but I was so young, and the bands that I was in, you know, they were never destined to do anything, right? But this was my actual first bona fide album that I'd worked on and helped write a few of the songs. Played guitar on these other ones that in Los Angeles, I was actually playing bass. You know, so this was my first. Wow. Shot it, you know, I'd been playing guitar for a while, but it was my first shot at playing guitar on an album, right? So yeah, it was my first album, and it was the first time I'd written a song for an album. And it's one of,
I'm sorry, go ahead. It's one of my favorites. It's the opening track, She Knows.
That's right. You're very good. Yeah.
You got the funk when you're feeling low down. Who's gonna love you when there's no one else around? Who's gonna help you, especially when you're sick?
I played this riff at one of the rehearsals, and Phil looked up at me and said, is that yours? And I said, you know, and he said, well, do you have anything? Is there any more to that song? And I said, well, yeah. And I played him more. And he loved the whole rhythmic side of it. Mm-hmm. And he said, do you mind if I write some lyrics to this? And I went, are you kidding? Absolutely. So what's really cool about that, it's my first album, the first song that I'd written with Phil Lynott, and it turns out to be the opening track on that album. So it's a very cool intro to the world of making albums.
Very cool. And I guess that's what happens a lot with guitars. They're noodling around or playing a riff that they've had in their head, and someone says, wait a minute, what the hell is that?
Yeah, because sometimes you really don't know what you have, you know?
Yeah.
Like you say, you've had it for a while, and maybe you're so used to it, maybe you're even kind of a little bored with it because you've played it so often, right? But it takes one person to go, you know, hey, that's pretty cool, man. I think we can do something with that. And when you do something with it and it comes out pretty nice, that is a very, very cool feeling.
That's a gift there. Now, Ron Nevison produces this album, big time producer. Yeah. What was Ron like in the studio?
Well, we never used him again.
Okay, so I guess that's very telling right there.
He was very controlling, you know. I remember, obviously, the rehearsals that we had for this album, and all guitars are on stun kind of thing. But when we got in with Ron, you slap your guitar and, you know, hit that first note, and you go, oh, wait a minute, can you just turn it down a little bit? Yeah, okay. Then you start again and go, oh, wait a minute, can you just turn it down just a little bit more, right?
No.
I'm looking at him going, really, man? Yeah, just go ahead. Just turn that down. Right? And to the point, he did it on all the tracks, you know, and all the tracks, they all lost all the heaviness, all their kind of meaning.
Yeah.
And to the point where I've dubbed it the cocktail album, you know.
Right.
Just put on some nice light music here, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, we never used them again. And that was it for Ron. For us, anyway.
All right. Well, let's move on. Another song that's in the set list of this live show that people are going to be able to buy in June is the song Suicide. It comes from the 1975 album Fighting, which was produced by Phil.
The people call it suicide. Bullet from a 45. Nobody cared, nobody cried. Don't that make you feel sad?
And for me, this is probably the album when the signature two guitar sound is fully realized. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would. I'd go along with that. You know, that was a song written before I got in the band. So yeah. I think Eric Bell as the trio.
Yeah.
They actually started that song and we actually finished it, right? We put a lot of extra bits in there, a lot more energy into it. And like you say, now, because the two guitars, we were able to, you know, put the different harmony guitars in there and all that to, you know, just kind of further that song on. I mean, there's only so much you can do in a trio. So yeah. when we got our hands on it, we were able to do this and that, and hey, let's go over here. Let's put a harmony on that side of it over there. I didn't really mind that it was written by another version of the band, but as long as we could put our own stamp on it, that was fine with me.
And again, with this album, Fighting and Phil producing, the guitars are turned up, and this is when the Thin Lizzy sound of your era really gets kicking.
Well, I would agree with that. Yeah, we were finally kind of let loose a little bit to show everybody more of what we could do. I think Brian Robertson came out really well on that album. He was able to stretch out more. I think lead guitar wise, I was still kind of learning my way into the system kind of thing. I'll be the first to admit that, right? And that's what was so great about being able to play with all these really great players. You know, you're standing up on stage with the Gary Moores, the Bryans, the Sykeses, you know, all these guys. And I could actually not necessarily steal from them, but I could use some of their ideas and use it in my own format, right? Yeah. So, and I've always said, if you don't learn from people who are better than you, then you're a fool, right? If you don't take anything away from these really great players, then you really are a foolish person, you know?
Absolutely.
I always call it that. It was my school of rock, you know. It's where I actually learned the craft, was in Thin Lizzy. And you know something, a lot of other guys did too. Most of them, I would say, I'd say everybody that came in and out of Thin Lizzy became not only a better person, but they became a better player, a better songwriter, just kind of a better everything. You know? So it was a good school for everybody.
That's cool. And you have two co-writes on the album Fighting, King's Vengeance and Freedom Song. All right, let's move on.
Yeah, Kings. I redid King's Vengeance on the one of our 21 Guns albums.
That's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah, because I said, you know, that it's not really quite right. It was never quite right the way we did it as Thin Lizzy. So I wanted to put that. I don't want to say wrong, but I wanted to put it a little bit more right. You know, with a bit more of a modern twist on it. So that's why I did that.
All right, cool. There's four songs in the set list from Jailbreak. We got Jailbreak, we got Warriors, we got Cowboy Song, we got The Boys Are Back in Town. The set list kicks off with Jailbreak, which for me is very ballsy. It's one of your biggest songs, and now the band has to follow themselves, so to speak.
Coming, I think it's best.
Well, and we also, most bands that have a big hit record, they will end off with their big hit record.
Right.
We did that. We always put, say, like the Boys Are Back, we always put it in the middle of the set.
Right.
Because we always figured that if you're only as good as that one song, you're not worth a shit anyway, right? So you got to follow it up and play great through the whole set. So you can't be all about one song, right?
True.
So, you know, we made sure that that song didn't get any more highlighted than any other song in the set. So that's why we put it smack dab in the middle, and then we tried to build from there.
That's kind of telling people that you guys feel that all your songs are good. They're all equal. Anything can be played anywhere.
Well, you know, that was a train of thought with us. You know, you can't listen to one song, people. You gotta listen to the whole thing. It's why today the streaming thing, you know, the musicians go out there and beating their heads on the ground, you know, producing these albums, and people go on to the street and just play one track, you know?
Yeah.
And they're missing out on so many other really great tracks. Unless they're like a dedicated fan and they will go out and buy the album. But it's to me, that's a little sad, you know, because the musicians really do put their heart and soul into these albums. And on every track, and you want every track to be heard. And these days, it's really not so much the case, which is unfortunate.
I'm still an album guy. That's why I loved your tenure in Black Star Riders. I thought that every one of those albums got better, better, better. So yeah, thank you for that.
Thank you. We can't fill a pack together. Back in the days of no surrender. Wishing things would only get better, but they never do. I'm always leaving, but I'll never leave. I'm always going, but I'll never go. I'm always thinking, but I'll never know. I'm always running, but I'll lose control. Whatever you're feeling, you are always the one. Whatever you did, you should always have done. Wherever you went, you should never have gone.
Now, the song Jailbreak, my friends and I have had fun with one of these lyrics for years. The opening lyric says, tonight there's going to be a jailbreak somewhere in the town. Now, Scott, I imagine that jailbreak's going to be at the jail, right?
That's absolutely right. You know, I love Phil and I love his lyrics, and he never stubs his toes on any of this, but he did that time. Right?
But the song, the riff is so good, you just overlook it.
But that single line has been picked out so many times, so many people taking the piss out of that, right?
Yeah.
And rightly so. I mean, even Phil, after he heard the first couple of jibes out, even he had to laugh. He goes, you know, I didn't have anywhere to go with that line, so I just put it in, you know?
What are you going to do? Still a classic.
In this town, see me and the boys, we don't like it, so we're getting up and going down. Hide low, looking right to left. If you see us coming, I think it's best you move away. Do you hear what I say from under my breath?
During this concert, when Phil introduces Warriors, he says that that's for Jimi Hendrix. And I never knew that until now. I didn't know that.
He was a massive Jimi Hendrix fan. Absolutely massive, right?
We're going to do a song that was written for Jimi Hendrix, this one.
It's a song called Warriors that goes with this.
Apparently, he told me one day that there was a director and producer that came along and wanted him to play Hendrix.
I heard that rumor.
Bio, right? And I said, yeah, but Phil, Jimmy's left-handed. You're right-handed. Right? He went, yeah, well, that's kind of where it fell down, right there. It never got taken any further. But I think, you know, so I think he would have done a really good job with that. If Hendrix was right-handed, I think Phil could have pulled it off.
Yeah, I agree.
Chin and all, you know.
The whole thing, yeah, amazing. Such an amazing looking front man. All that talent, and then the way Phil holds the spotlight is just incredible. There's no one like him.
Oh, he owned it.
He owned it.
He owned the spotlight. The one of the really great traits of Phil is he did not want to be the Lone Ranger up there. He wanted each guy in the band to have spotlights, right? Because he felt, you know, band members who were known in their own right was going to make a much stronger unit than the audience just knowing one guy, right?
Right.
So he actually went out of his way to promote each and every guy in the band. You know, I mean, we all went off and did our own interviews and got on TV shows by ourselves and all that. And he loved all that. So, like I said, he wanted everybody to have their own spotlight. So you don't see too many singers that want to kind of share the spotlight with, you know, the guys that are back by their amps in the shadows. You know?
What usually happens is the guy, the front man, he's doing all the press, he's doing all that. And then he starts to get resentful. Like, why am I doing all this work? And then they go off and do a solo project and the band ends. So,
But they should be glad about that because it brings more spotlight to them because you were the guy who chose them to be in the band. And, you know, it just kind of.
Absolutely.
Goes on.
All right. There's two songs in the set list from the album Johnny the Fox. We got Don't Believe a Word, which is killer.
Don't believe me if I tell you. Not a word of this is true. Don't believe me if I tell you. Especially if I tell you. I'm in love with you. Don't believe me if I tell you. That I wrote this song for you. That just might be some other suit for the girl.
And of course, Johnny the Fox meets Jimmy the Weed.
Johnny the Fox! He called to Jimmy the Weed. He said, hey man, I know your name. I seen you cruising with the lowriders. Hanging out down on First Street in Maine.
Here's my question about the Johnny the Fox album. Jailbreak comes out in March 1976, and then Johnny the Fox comes out a few months later in October. Why release another studio album so quickly when Jailbreak is doing so well? It's basically your big breakthrough.
No, you're absolutely right. What were we thinking? You know, I think that was management getting kind of greedy. You know, hey, let's put another album out there instantly. And then guess what? You guys will never come off the road, right? We were always pounded into our psyche that if you ever came off the road, everybody was going to forget about you. They keep on saying this to the point where we were almost kind of believing it, right? Mm-hmm. You know, nowadays, bands will take 2 years off before coming out with a new album and then go out and do the big worldwide tour. But back then, it was kind of a completely different way of thinking. But I'm pretty sure that's the way it was. The management, at least 50% of the management anyway, were a little bit greedy, and they figured the more albums out, the more money they were going to get, kind of deal. I don't think it did us any harm, but on the other hand, I don't think it did us any good either.
Yeah.
I think we should have waited had that lapse of time before we brought out the next album. So because what it did is it put that much more pressure on the album after that.
Yeah.
Because we had no songs really ready to get up and go for that next album, you know, which, what was it? Was that Black Rose? I think it was, right?
Which one?
After Johnny the Fox.
Bad Reputation was next.
Ah, okay. Right.
With Tony Visconti.
Right. Who helped out a lot on that album. I have to admit.
Okay, Sydney. You got a bad reputation. That's the word out on this town. It gives a certain fascination, but it can only weigh you down. You better turn yourself around. Turn yourself around. Turn it upside down.
Both Phil and Tony were just encouraging me like hell, because I wasn't sure if I was maybe ready to be the Lone Ranger guitar player kind of thing. And both Phil and Tony were going, absolutely, you're wrong. You are the guy, you know? And, you know, the further we got into the album, the more the writing that Phil and I got into it, I completely got, my confidence up and running. And I think it actually turned out to be a really cool album with a lot of great songs on it, you know? So.
Yeah, it really is. And did Tony have a vision for the band when he came in?
Vision. If he did, he never told me about it. No, I think Tony was the kind of guy, whatever project he was on, he wanted to make that the best that it could possibly be at that moment in time. Vision, I will give you an example of, like, did he have a vision with somebody else?
Well, here's the problem. Now I don't even know what I'm talking about, Scott.
Okay, at least you're honest. Okay.
Let's move on to the song Waiting for an Alibi, which you guys played live in Australia. That song wasn't even released yet.
No.
And
no, you're right.
And it was the fans welcomed it with open arms because that's a killer track.
Right.
Why do you got? Why do you got? He says he has.
I think what happened, we had just done the Black Rose album, and this tour came up, right?
Yeah.
So we went out and we decided, well, you know, the album's not even out, so let's not really play any of the songs off it, right? But, you know, let's give a little taster of, you know, what's to come, and waiting for an alibi, you know, ourselves and the record company figured, well, it's going to be a great single.
Yeah.
Which it turned out to be. It was a really successful song on the charts and all that. But yeah, that'll be the only song from the Black Rose album.
Now, this is the first album you guys make without Brian Robertson. Were you guys feeling invigorated with Gary Moore in the studio? Because that guy was fantastic.
Killer guitar player. I mean, killer player. And he came up with great parts, you know. I mean, you mentioned Wait for an Alibi there. So, okay, it's my solo, right? And Gary says, well, let's do a little tag thing on the end. Which is kind of to get it right. And then you do it on the upscale also, right? All the way up, right? Which, you know, fingering-wise and timing-wise and all that, that takes some practice and some work. But when he first showed it to me, I went, really, Gary? Really? But he showed it to me, and with, you know, three or four goes, I had it, and we put it down, and it was fine, right? But now you got to do it every night on tour. Yeah. So thanks a lot, Gary.
One of the songs that you co-wrote on Black Rose is Got to Give It Up, song about addiction.
Tell my mama and tell my pa that their fine young son didn't get far. He made it to the end of a bottle, sitting in a sleazy bar. He tried hard, but his spirit broke. He tried until he he lost his bottle, drinking alcohol.
Right.
What was the state of your addiction and Phil's addiction at the time you write this song?
We were probably about equal at that point. Yeah, we were in Paris recording this, the Black Rose album. And, you know, sometimes at night we'd go out to a club or whatever. And I got to say, you know, drug dealers were, Phil was a magnet for these guys, right? Yeah. Here's this and here's that and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, one afternoon he calls me up in my room and says, hey, man, you know, why don't you come down? I've got something I want to show you. Okay. So he comes down, pulls out the little packet. I look at it. He goes, you know what that is? I went, yeah, man, I know exactly what that is, because I'd already been doing it in Los Angeles before I even got there. And England kind of saved my life, so I wouldn't have to be around that anymore. And there it is right in front of me. And one of my best friends in the whole world is holding it, right? So he said, so do you want to try some? I went, yeah, you know, and that was us kind of off and running in the wrong direction, if you will.
But you guys write a song about addiction while you're both using drugs. It's so you knew that you had a problem that you had to kick. And yet,
you knew it was wrong. You knew it was wrong. And why are we doing this? Well, most of it was because it was fun at the time. You know?
Right, of course.
All that stuff is. It's great fun in the beginning. And then you start to get into the middle stages, and now it starts to become a problem. And later on, it's a real problem, right?
Yeah.
But I think it was kind of prophetic on Phil's side to know that we got to give this. We got to give this stuff up. This is going to be the road to nowhere. It's not going to do us any good. We've got to give it up, right?
Yeah.
I did find that a bit funny when he came up with the lyrics for this, right? But
yeah,
I kind of got it. You had to get it, you know. So
yeah.
Everyone
has their thing that they want to give up, whether it's coffee or two Coca-Cola
nicotine
afternoon, nicotine, whatever it is.
I'm still doing it, you know.
Yeah, that's one of the most addictive ones, is what they tell me.
It really is, and I'm such a lily-livered weak person. I've been sucking on that e-cigarette for like 15 years. You know, you're supposed to wean yourself off of this stuff, for God's sakes, you know?
So we only have sadly, only a couple more minutes with you, Scott. I want to talk about, you left Black Star Riders. I think you said you wanted to concentrate on Thin Lizzy projects. Is that true?
Well, I said I want to try to, right?
Okay.
The problem with the whole Thin Lizzy thing these days is I love the idea of well-known guys from well-known bands, you know, coming in and playing all the Thin Lizzy songs.
Yeah.
Because nearly all of these guys, they're all Thin Lizzy fans, and they all have their Thin Lizzy songs that they love to play, and they'd love to be up there in that situation playing them themselves, right? But that's, it was pretty easy to find a lot of these guys, you know. But I realize now that on a couple of those tours, how lucky we were in our timing, because everybody else has a day job, right? And it's what pays the mortgage and keeps their kids in shoes or whatever. Not like most of these guys need that money anyway, right? But there is a real scheduling problem, right?
Yeah.
So to fill these balls, trying to get everybody on the same page at the same time is a really tough thing to do. So I would like to do it again, absolutely, but it's going to have to be all those ducks lined up kind of thing, and figure out who, when, and where, and what, and why, and blah blah blah, so it's I know it's a terrible answer, Pat. I know it's
it makes sense.
I understand. Real crap sit on the fence kind of answer, but it's the only thing to give right now.
Look, the last time you guys went out, you had Tom Hamilton from Aerosmith. You got Scott Travis from Judas Priest. Those guys have commitments with their big bands, so I understand.
Yeah, and they gotta go.
Yeah, and then Ricky's new Black Star Riders album's coming out in January. But there's going to be 10th anniversary reunion shows in 2023. Yep. You're going to be part of some of those shows?
I will be on some of them, because I want to get up and help them celebrate, the 10th anniversary. After all, it was Ricky and I that started BSR and all that.
Yeah.
It's another Mill night in downtown Babylon. The contract for blood ain't worth a paper that it's on. To the dark side of the road where the junkies playing high. It's a one-way ticket on a slow death suicide. Don't you turn your back. Don't you turn your back. Don't you turn your back. Now there's a silver glory of the coming of the fools. But all hell breaks loose, all hell breaks loose. I walk a murder mile wearing dead man's shoes. But all hell breaks loose, all hell breaks loose.
It'd be terrible if I didn't get up there at least do a couple of songs with him, So
yeah,
and Rick still, he's still one of my best friends ever. I love the guy to death. I love everybody that actually went through that band. It's the reason they got into the band, because they're really cool guys and they're really great musicians, right? So why wouldn't you want to get up there and do at least a couple of songs?
Yeah, exactly.
Go around the country. So yeah, that's my plan, is to. I'm not sure, when and where, these gigs are going to be, but be assured that I will get up there at certain times.
Excellent. Last question. It's kind of a sideways question. It's an Asia question.
Oh, God.
Because in 1990, you play on an Asia song when they were between guitarists. You played on a song, Summer Can't Last Too Long.
Looking to the future, searching for the girl. Not too much like the last one, just the prettiest in.
At that time, were you asked to join Asia?
Here's what happened, right? The two boys came and asked me, would I help them out with some demos? Because they needed to, present them to the record company. And they came up with this fantastic number of how much money they were going to get through the whole thing. But they just didn't have the guitar player. And I said, yeah, sure. I'll go in the studio and do the demos with you, you know. And I think I only played like on two tracks.
Yeah.
And there were demos. Now you got to remember, when you're doing demos, it's a frame of mind where you go, you get the solo up to a certain scratch, right? And you go, well, okay, listen, that's good enough. It kind of gives you the idea of, you know, where this was going. It doesn't have to be perfect. Okay. And they were going, yeah, no, it's great. It's fine. Thank you so much. Right. And then the next thing I know, it's on the album.
It's released.
Okay. This demo. And I call up John. I said, John, what's going on here? That was a demo. He goes, yeah, but we liked it so much and we couldn't find anybody else to do it right. Man, geez, I hope you don't mind. I went, well, not much I can do about it now.
No.
I wish you would have said something, but. Right. And so everybody, I've had this question a lot. So you were in Asia? No, I was not in Asia. So that's your answer. That's the long version.
Scott, thank you so much for your time. Again, June 24th, everyone, you can pre-order it now. The Boys Are Back in Town Live. Plus, it's got the documentary Songs for While I'm Away featuring Scott Gorham. This will be the hardest question maybe, Scott. I want you to tell me what song from Scott Gorham's career would you like me to use as the playout song today?
Wow. How about the song, We Will Be Strong?
I love it. Thanks so much, Scott. Continued success. I hope to see you down the road sometime again. And please enjoy We Will Be Strong.
Thank you, man. I had a great time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Streets at night, checking the time. is attack. A woman is away from me. But we will be strong. I know we have the strength. Questions are why? Does anybody hear? Does anybody understand? Let me make it clear. Now's the time to take a stand. Now, woman.